Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Some kind of an accident.
There is no evidence of a conspiracy.
These people were killed, and whoever killed them is going to try to kill me. Austin thinks that maybe we all saw something up there.
We're in the business of reporting the news, not creating it.
You've been asking questions about me and things you know nothing about.
What I know is I need a good alias and I need a good ID.
Who are you?
You know, there for a moment, I thought you were a man.
My life is in danger just being here.
And whoever's behind this is in the business of recruiting assassins. I think I got some of their entrance exams.
Congratulations, Richard. You had some very interesting scores on the first series of tests for Parallax.
You know, your tests suggest that you have remarkable talents.
In a risk situation, I believe you'll go right down the line.
You see, the very quality that gets you in trouble is what makes you potentially invaluable.
We're prepared to offer you the most lucrative and rewarding work of your life.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to All the President's Minutes. This is not another episode discussing Alan Pakula's 1976 masterpiece, All the President's Men. In fact, it's a special bonus episode of the show, a second part of our special limited series, The Parallax Views. Imprint Films, which is Australia's primo brand new Blu-ray boutique label, is bringing out a stack of incredible releases, and I've been completely honored and overwhelmed with the responsibility of doing a commentary track for The Parallax View, which is the centerpiece of Alan Pakula's Paranoia trilogy. And thanks so much to a couple of people who like what we do, the expectation was like, well, Blake, if you've done a commentary track, surely that means that there's a forthcoming Parallax View podcast of some description. And to be brutally honest, there wasn't at that time. During my preparation for that piece and making sure that I was really well researched, one of the tenets of my research was an incredible talk hosted by the Denver Library, which was with one of my guests today. The other two people who were on that Denver Library talk about the Parallax View were Karen Kusama and Phil Hay. But my guest today is the man who hosts a raft of these incredible Denver Library sessions. You can go and find them all over the place. A whole stack of movies, a whole bunch of incredible creators, writers, etc., filmmakers, all of those kind of people. He is easily in the top three living film critics. He is easily one of the most staggeringly intimidating writers to read, because whenever you know that he's already reviewed a movie, you want to stay so far away from it because you're just going to be overwhelmed by what he can bring to it. And a man whose actual content I've recently taught in a class to students. That's how good he is. His great profane and profound piece as part of David Fincher's Voir series on 48 Hours is truly just truly one of the best pieces of film criticism that's ever been turned into a video essay. That is my guest. I would not be doing this without him. And I basically, he has a standing invitation to basically anything I do. He is my friend, Walter Chaw. Walter, thank you so much for chatting to me about this movie.
Look, whenever you pick up the phone, I answer. so anytime you call, I'm ready to come on.
Oh God, such a pleasure. Look, I don't want to run you back too much over familiar territory, but I was so impressed and such a voracious consumer of your Parallax View discussion, conversation, unpacking with Karen Kusama and Phil Hay, that I thought, I'd love to get a chance to talk to you about it. It is truly one of my favorite films. And really, you couldn't have the 1970s without Alan Pakula's Paranoia Trilogy. They're right in the midst of that great new Hollywood era. Can you tell me what this movie means to you?
Well, I saw it as a freshman in college. It was part of this course that I was taking called Ways of Seeing. It was one of the more important courses that I've ever taken in any topic. And, you know, part of the curricula for it was this film. It was The Conversation, The Stuntman, movies that I'd not seen before. And going into it, I thought of myself as kind of a cinephile. I loved Hitchcock already. I raised myself, it felt like, on film. To a large extent, I think I learned how to speak English because I watched American films, so it was kind of a shocker to all of a sudden be confronted with all of these titles that I'd never heard before. And this is, VCRs had been a thing for about 10 years at that point. I'm very elderly, but it was still a relatively new technology. And so, there was a lot of stuff that we were still sorting through. And, I was obsessed with like the science fiction and the sci-fi and stuff. So, the 70s were really unpacked for me in college. And so that was the first time I saw it. And I couldn't believe it. It's so bleak. It's so pessimistic about us. The more that I learned from that course, movies like kind of The Conversation and stuff, the more I learned about the 70s and this idea of the hero in the 70s, the American hero, had been subverted from our American history of the lone hero, the cowboy Shane or John Wayne riding into town and fixing stuff, had been overturned. And it got me into a larger conversation with film as a sociological exercise. What were the films of the 50s saying about us when we're talking about giant ants and people turning into pods overnight? Well, it's clear, in the 60s, what are we talking about with the counterculture? In the 70s, what are we talking about with all of these paranoid films? And where, our biggest heroes from the 70s are played by not like John Wayne or Humphrey Bogart or Clark Gable. They're played by guys like Dustin Hoffman. And, when you get somebody that's really beautiful, like Warren Beatty, he's kind of, making fun of that in a movie like Shampoo, or he's like, defacing himself in some way, or he plays a scumbag, or he plays like a loser like Joe Frady in Parallax View, who, whether or not he's like super successful, he's only as successful as he is, I guess I would say. He's not like world famous, he's not whatever, he's a bad boyfriend, he's a bad listener, he's a the scene with Paula Prentice breaks my heart every time I see it, when she shows up and tries to get him to believe her. And then the very next scene, the smash cut to her being zipped up in a body bag. It's brutal and heartbreaking, especially if you know that, you know, her recent history at the time of the shooting of the movie. She had just had a nervous breakdown. I'd spent some time away in a hospital, I think. And so, you know, she's playing something that's very close to her. And there's a real, she's not thought of as an actress, but I think she gives a beautiful performance here. And she kind of parallels for me, the feeling of the movies of the 70s and the feeling that there's something happening and no one's listening to me. And, and, you know, we see it so much now, I think, when, you know, we're all jaded, but I think in the 70s, there's still a bit of a loss of innocence that was possible for us and learning about how corrupt the government was, how debased our leadership is. Corporations are indicted by the parallax view, you know, the sort of murder incorporated on a grand scale. I think there's still room for us to lose some innocence in the 70s. The movies of the 70s are this process of losing innocence in the United States and around the world to some extent. And but now when we get movies like this, like Parallax View, it's almost impossible, it feels like, to satirize our current state anymore. You know, you can't make anything, you know.
Anything funnier than reality at this point.
No. How can you make anything more brutal? You know, and when you look back on the great films of the 60s and 70s, like the Manchurian Candidate, for instance, you know, the Frankenheimer version, when that first came out, people were saying, you know, this is science fiction. This is way overboard. This is too much. And now it's this sort of like cozy and, you know, or the Dead Zone in the 80s, where the maniacal leader, you know, the horrible authoritarian fascist, holds up a child to stave off an assassination attempt, and that ends his candidacy. But we know that if that happened today, that if one of these fascist leaders held up a child in front of him when assassin took aim, he'd be praised by his followers. There's nothing that they could do to be loathsome to their followers. And so all of these, like, movies, these cautionary movies, the Parallax Views and the Klutz and all this stuff now seem naive almost, because yes, we've fallen so far off the table. But, you know, for me, Parallax View is still you know, the beginning of that, I don't want to use too crass a term, but sort of that deflowering for me, where you grow up in the United States really indoctrinated into this sense of patriotism and the feeling that America is the greatest place in the world and the greatest nation on earth, and, you know, our ideals and our constitution and all of these things are ironclad. And then you know, at a certain point, I think all of us began to be disabused of that notion, you know. and we go in one of two directions. You know, we either become these ferocious liberals, you know, of which I think I'm one. I'm a terrible atheist liberal guy, you know, anti-fascist, and or you go the other way, where your fear instead of driving you to outrage drives you to denial, and you cling more, you know, strongly to these images of the flag and images of patriotism. And, you know, Parallax View, I think, predicts that and plays with that a little bit as well, with the landmarks that it uses, the Space Needle, but also the giant American flags and the idea, especially the parallax test, which is extraordinary. But you know, these images of hearth and home being perverted.
Going to say, I'm so glad you brought up that scene, because when Phil and Karen came on the show for the first part of this episode, I said, I don't want to ask you your favorite scenes. I want to guess. I want to see if I can guess what your favorite scenes are. And for Karen, I said, the most Karen Kusama style scene in the film for me is that exact exchange, the Paul Apprentice and Warren Beatty scene in the apartment, because it's showing this, like, true raw emotional turmoil, and it's showing her, like, being so truthful and him being so dismissive, and they couldn't be further away from each other's wavelengths. And it takes so much of that conversation for them to even get close to one another. And then we don't even get to see them reconcile. We see silhouette, we see closeness, we see comfort, and then bang, as you said, smash cut to death. And she's just like, you know, Karen was like, I'm so glad you said that scene, because it is my favorite. And she's like, everything about it, the formalism, the acting, the intent, the tension, and the way that it's scripted. And then I guessed Phil's favorite. I said, really, I was like, look, I think your favorite scene because of musicality of script is the when Frady goes to visit the psychologist with the parallax test. And then he gets visited by Jack Younger, who's like, you did really well on our test. And he goes, you know what? I wouldn't have said that, but I would have said any scene that has Jack Younger in it is my favorite. And I was like, yeah, look, I think I had you both pegged. But when I was thinking about you and what your favorite scene would be in this film, it was so much harder because as I was thinking about it, I was thinking like, I know you have such an affinity for really great orchestrations of tension because of your Hitchcock background. So I know you would love the plane scene, but I also know that you're a deeply empathetic person. And I truly feel that Paul Apprentice scene is like that's like a Hall of Fame performance. And so I know that your empathy, I feel like I could never toss up between what I know about your sort of, your formal, like as a person who really digs into formalism, as opposed to a person who really jives with like really, I don't know, truthful, authentic emotion. So I couldn't find a way to bridge the gap between those two, thinking of what your favorite scene would be. But at least now I know that you love that Paul Apprentice scene.
I do. I adore it. But I think my favorite film, my favorite piece, chunk of the movie is the parallax test.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
You will now please cross to the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you, except to observe the visual materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. All right. We hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Thank you.
You know, just the, is it Michael Small who does the score for this, the score of it, the images, you know, the thesis that I wrote for that course that I told you about was a image by image breakdown of the parallax test, which was much harder to do before the internet. You know, so I spent
incredibly hard. You would have broken a VHS pausing to get every image.
I spent 40 hours in the library. I remember doing it, looking through National Geographic, looking through old Life magazines, looking through all these things to try to find those images. And it was like, and I did, you know, I was able to locate the sources for most of those. And I think, you know, I was stunned by it because I was still really naive at that point too, by experimental film. I had not been exposed to Sam Brackage or those guys. And so, or even Andy Warhol. And so seeing like a collage that was sort of integrated, like a little experimental film integrated into a larger narrative piece, was mind blowing to me. Yeah. Mind blowing. You know, the closest that I had seen before that was 2001, where the light tunnel sequence is sort of like a film within a film. Yes. I mean, you know, all of a sudden in the middle of a movie, you have another movie for a while, and that's literally the case for Parallax View. And I would say that's probably my favorite, just because, you know, I love the mystery of this film, the idea that there's a mystery that's solved, but nothing is solved. And that's the case of so many movies, great movies from the 70s, like Night Moves, you know, a movie that came out the year after this, it was so good, right? And the detective, Gene Hackman, solves everything, but he knows nothing. And that's sort of the 70s. It's like, you know, the higher you climb, literally the parallax view, the less you know, the more of a perspective that you have, whether it's from the top of the Space Needle or it's from the rafters at the convention, you know less when you've discovered what the truth is. And that's, you know, I've seen this film described as nihilistic. I'm not sure it's entirely nihilistic. I think there's still a little bit of hope left in it. But for me, it leaves me feeling so desolate, you know, because I think the older that I get, the more I realize how little I know. The more that I learn about things, the less I understand anything. The world was much simpler to me 20 years ago.
Yes.
You know, everything made a lot more sense when I was in my 20s than they do in my 40s. You know, my 20s, I knew who was right in World War II. In the 20s, I knew who was, you know, and there's certain things that are, you know, absolutes, obviously, but you know, when we firebomb Japan for a month before we drop the bomb on them, I don't know anymore that that's an ethical thing that we did. And you know, you say warfare, you know, it becomes very difficult and gray for me to begin to untangle my feelings about these things as I get older. And Parallax View seems to be prescient about that. It says that, you know, and most of the films in the 70s too, the great films, they say that the more that you know and the more that you unpack about the machinery that drives the world, the less that it makes sense and the less that you can kind of gain any kind of comfort from that knowledge. You know, there's a line from Oedipus where Tiresias, the blind seer, he says, how terrible is wisdom when it brings no profit to the wise. and I think that's so, you know, that's the 70s, you know, that we learned that our president's corrupt. We learned that our military is corrupt. We learned that we were, you know, 10 minutes away from nuclear annihilation. We learned that this, we learned all this stuff. What good has it done us? You know, and now we're at the 24-hour news cycle where we know everything all the time. And I'm at a place now where it's like, until you're just showing me accountability, I would rather just not even know.
Yeah.
Yes. Just what's the point of me knowing more about what I already know? You know, this person was texting this person on January 6th. This person was, I know. You know, when you're putting them, when you're perp walking them and putting them in irons, that's what I want to know again. But at this point, wisdom just hurts.
I almost feel the same about everything that's around, you know, the pandemic response, especially in our country and things like that. It's like, you hear about these things and it's like, look, I almost want to buy a subscription to a newspaper so you can send it to my house. And if they're on the front page and someone is being held accountable for a horrendous wrongdoing, then I can see it on the front page and I can dig in. And if it's not there and it's just trash, I'm going to flick that page, I'm going to go to the next thing to find out if there's any pertinent news, and then I'm going to shut it, and I'm going to throw it in the recycle bin, and it's gone. Like, that's my news. I'm so, you know, we're both engaged on Twitter in a variety of ways, but that's those things. I want to just say two things before we continue. First is, I love that you brought up Night Moves. I'm a big fan of a movie called Twilight that's coming out soon, and a little tidbit about that is that the director of Twilight goes into great detail to say that his two favorite detectives that inspired him, one was Harry Mosby, from Nightmoves, Gene Hackman's character in 1975. And his character, who Paul Newman plays, Harry Ross, is named after Ross McDonald, who wrote the original Harper novels, and Harry Mosby. So it's Harry Ross. Like, it's not just a implicit connection anymore. I think it's like it's the text itself. But I also think, like you said, with the absolute truths that we know, it's been really refreshing in some teaching that I've been doing with some students, like recapping on big historical events and talking to kids who don't necessarily have the context. I'm the conduit to this context. And I literally had a student ask at one point, why did they bomb Japan like that? Why did they drop two nuclear bombs? And what I realized in formulating an answer was, I don't know. I don't know why there certainly wasn't necessarily tactical at that moment. And probably the uncomfortable thing is they had two types and they wanted to test them both. And it's the ugly truth of it is kind of that. And you kind of settle on the fact that, well, it's hypothesized that they basically had two, and it was, they were going to bomb them regardless of whether they surrendered with one after one. They were bombing them twice, and that's what it was.
Yeah, and there's a compelling theory about the end of the war, too, that it wasn't really the bombing that was upsetting the Japanese. It was Stalin finally taking a side. And so, thus calling into question the necessity for using the technology in the first place. And so, yes. There's a thing in the new Eternals movie, which I thought was pretty abominable, but there's this theory that they put forth in it that the reason that these eternal beings, those all-powerful beings that are overseeing the earth, allowed things like Hiroshima to happen and stuff is because it's during warfare that humans evolve their technology most quickly, especially medical technology.
Yes.
And so therefore it was in their best interest because they wanted population to explode on the planet to allow wars to happen. Now, that's one of many things that are extraordinarily stupid and problematic about the film, but it is true that World War II was was sort of an experimental ground for medicine and for technology in the worst possible ways. And the reasons that we have, let a lot of Germans off the hook, and the reasons that Japan was, anyway, it's like the more that I know, the more that I read, the more sorry I am that I know, and the more sorry that I am that I have contacts, that I have different points of view, that I have different arguments for this or that. And it used to be so simple. Dear man. We had to do it so that we could save lives and American lives. I was like, that makes total sense to me. And the more we go along, it's like, yeah, we leveled a lot of Japanese cities with firebombing. And so the architecture is paper-based. It's a war crime, flat out, straight up.
Yeah.
And I can't get over that. And it's really difficult for me to sit here and say, I wish I could go back. I wish I could be as clear about things. But then if I were as clear about things, if I was so dogged and jealous of my ignorance, then I would be on the other side. And now I'm not getting a vaccination. Now Trump is my golden calf. And so there's an issue. And what the parallax view does really kind of brilliantly is it frustrates our desire for justice. It frustrates these things that we're talking about when we say, I'm just gonna turn the page, I'm gonna scroll up, I'm gonna like not read this, I'm gonna do whatever. Parallax views is that sort of frustration of justice as well. It says, like, we know who, we never really knew who the bad guys are. Who runs the Parallax Corporation? It's like one of those, message board lines in a high rise, Parallax View Corporation, second floor, I think, or something. There's nobody there. It's an empty room. It's the voice of God. It's a low level functionary that visits your apartment and lies there in the bed when you come home. Like that's and what I love about the Parallax View too is that I don't know if he passes the test or if he fails it. I have no idea what the test is testing. You get glimpses of like a test that the sociopath took, on paper, because he's looking through the sheriff's drawers and you see it. If you freeze it, you can read some of the questions. You can do, have you ever been humiliated? Do you laugh at the wrong times? Stuff like that. That's fascinating stuff. And it could speak to sociopathy. It could also speak to autism. What is it that you're actually testing for? Walter, is it an empathy test?
It can test. I've literally seen questions like that in a corporate culture suitability test. And I'm like, hold on. Did I take the fucking parallax test? Did I take that
beyond satire at this point.
Yes.
You know, we're beyond the ability to make a scary science fiction scenario about the downfall of a country because we're living in fallen countries.
Yes.
We're in the midst of fallen countries. That's what's happening. When we can go out on the street, we can step over a corpse. We're in the middle of a fallen country.
Yeah.
You know, this is like Argentina in the 80s. This is like, you know, Libya. This is like all of these places that we use as touchstones for places that are dangerous. We live there, you know, now. You in Australia, me in the United States. It's like we're actually there. We have a large contingent of white supremacists, and our notions of what's real and what's not have been perverted beyond repair. And that's also the parallax view. And, these movies are so current. If only we had listened. You know, these are all Cassandras. These were warnings back when there was still time to do something about it. But there's not. And I think it all goes back for us here in the States, where, you know, the end of the 60s, all of our progressive leaders were murdered. You know, one by one, the Fred Thompsons and the
Medgar Evers
and Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Bobby Kennedy. Progressives were murdered one by one, and you see progressives only just now peeking their heads back out again in the current state. But, you know, the old guard Democrats, they're centrists, they're not progressives, because they all got assassinated. And it was made very clear that if you have progressive ideas in the United States, you're going to get murdered. The moment that Fred Thompson painted a big bullseye on his chest when he was talking about a general strike, that's something the United States will not allow. And so, yes. You know, you get a brilliant generational leader like Fred, and he says something about a general worker strike. Yeah, the FBI is going to have to take you out. And so there's the, you know,
because you're capitalism. He's far too compelling. He's far too compelling, yep. And he's
too dangerous. You
know, there's a great line in Michael Mann's Ali that's given to Jamie Foxx's Bundini Brown. And he says, the truth tastes good when you've had a belly full of lies. And it feels like that line could have been every one of those guys. It hits, you know, people say, you know, in the parlance of the kids today, it's like, it hits different. It hits different when people are speaking the truth and it's so profoundly incisive. And you're like, oh my God. And I think you just said something that I think maybe like is the Rosetta Stone for how I unlock a lot of these films from New Hollywood. It's like, why didn't we listen? It's all here. It's all here in so many, whether it's expressed in the conversation, whether it's expressed in the parallax view, whether it's expressed as overtly as it gets in Network, like it's there. Like they know where it's going. These artists as prophets know where it's going. And it's just completely flagrantly ignored. Like, I don't know.
It's expressed in The Godfather, you know? I mean, it opens with,
who's being naive now, Kay? Who's being naive now,
right, exactly, Kay. Exactly. But it opens with a line like, I believe in America. You know, I believe in these things. But what is he there for? He's there looking for justice because the American system does not provide it for him.
Yes.
And so, you know, you see the roots of organized crime. You see the roots of all of this discontent. And the most dangerous thing that we could ever do is, you know, lift the veil and say, you know what, the real villains here are the people that are running the Parallax Corporation. It isn't, you know, the lesbian taco stand. It isn't the black guy down the street. It's not the Chinese guy on a podcast. That if we could all just figure out that we're on the same side, we're all united in poverty and struggle, you know, and we're all filling the pockets of like 10 people. That's the danger for them, you know, if we could ever lift the veil. And the 70s seem to be largely about this, but there are also these, like in the conversation in Parallax View and Night Moves, you know, these movies that we're talking about, that there's the individual cannot win in these scenarios. They can learn the truth, but it's like, you know, Icarus, right? You know, you can learn the truth, not the Eternals, but the actual Icarus, where you fly too close to the sun. And you see the face of God, or if you want to be Old Testament and everything, and it makes you insane or makes you dead. And there's no, like, you know, it's like an H.P. Lovecraftian thing, capitalism. It's like you see the face of the elder gods and it actually makes you nuts. Because you know that you can't fight them. You know that you can't win. And you know, that's what I think the Parallax View's ultimate message is like, you know, there, if there's hope here, it's that we can all talk to each other, you know, and we can all listen. But I think as external evidence has shown, We don't do that very well. You know, the other thing that really breaks my heart consistently, no matter how many times I watch Parallax View, is the death of the editor, Hugh Cronin. And him eating the sandwich, and then the very next scene, another sort of brutal cut of him sort of, you know, sitting up with his mouth open dead. And that's like, that's the death of hope here. That's the death of communication. You know, you kill the Cassandra, you know, the Paul Apprentice character, but then you kill the media. Yes. And then you kill, you know, and so it's like our faith in our institutions is gone, and the people who would speak truth to power are gone. What's left? And that's the challenge that these movies provide for us, I think.
Oh no, I think you're so spot on. It's that whole piece of, you've got, and even like William Daniels, he's isolated, and Paul Apprentice is isolated, and Hume Cronin is really Joe Frady's like main connection in the entire movie. And then he's ultimately isolated because Joe's off being this sort of, you know, staunch individualist, you know, playing like, you know, this gentleman spy almost. And then in one moment he's like Smokey and the Bandit, and then another moment he's like the globetrotting journalist who's going to uncover, you know, the intrepid journalist who's uncovering this thing. And it's like all of these professions that in some way or another these pieces satirize in segments of the film. Every single time he does that, it's just over and again he's showing us like the individual doesn't win. Like all of our generic conventions that say that these individuals have got a pathway to beat the big bad, it's just a lie. And it's like, you can totally see why the escapist fair concurrently going along, whether it's through the late 50s and early 60s and all those sorts of things with like James Bond, it's like, we want to believe that there is these individual heroes who can take these gigantic interplanetary, intergalactic, if you get to Luke Skywalker, forces down. But the harsh truth is that most of them end up like our old friend Captain Willard, and we kill the beast to become it, you know? Like that's ultimately the tragedy of the thing. And Phil brought up this great question of Joe Frady's character too. It's like, and you riffed on it in a slightly different thing, but I think it's another great question is, we don't know if like Frady is suitable for Parallax because he actually is, or because he's pretending to be. And that question also haunts me a little bit too. It's like, are we just playing into their hands? It's another theme that is part of this beautiful film. And
yeah, you know, for a long time I was in corporate America, you know, for 30 years, and I've done hundreds, maybe even thousands of interviews. And, you know, whenever I was training new managers or training new people to do these interviews, they would ask me, they're like, how do you know when they're lying? And I was like, well, they're all lying. It's just a matter of whether they're cutting enough to lie well. And that's what I'm thinking about when you're talking about the test, is like, you don't actually know what they're looking for when you're doing the test. Just like people, you don't really know what you're looking for when, you know, you're sitting down to be interviewed for a job. Except that, you know, I think for me, when I was interviewing, there was the expectation for me that people were lying about their credentials or lying about what they would do in certain scenarios when you're doing these sort of situational interviews that have become popular in the last 10 years or so. And it's like, you know that they're lying, but are they cunning enough to lie? Are they cunning enough to lie well? Are they cunning enough to know what it is that you want to hear? Because that could be the sign that they're the right person for you. And that's like, you know, so you're playing this parallax game with them, right? And, you know, the whole concept of parallax, where there is one objective truth, but there's like 10,000 different points of view from which you can look at it, which make it very confusing. And so how do you take, you know, how do you triangulate the truth from 10 different points of view? That's sort of the challenge that the film presents. And, you know, that being a grown-up presents to you as you navigate the world too. It's like, how do you know what's right? How do you know what's true? You know, with Omicron and Delta and what's next, you know, Zeta and Theta, and, you know, as these new variants come up and 10 different people tell you 5 different things. And does it really make a difference if I'm going to go eat in a restaurant, the 10 feet that I walk from the front door to the table while I'm wearing a mask and then I take the mask off? I don't really understand exactly how much of this is performative for each other. What is it that we're sending the message for and to, and what is the message that we're sending by doing it or not doing it? You know, the death eyes that I give to the guys walking to the bathroom without their masks on in a restaurant. It's like, but really what is happening here? You know, we're just kind of all, all dealing with the same sort of objective truth that there's a deadly virus, but there are 30 different points of view about what's safe and how to approach it. And, you know, Parallax View is identifying a national sickness, an epidemic of murder, and, you know, but how do we approach it? How do we begin to attack it? And what points of view do we need to, you know, to draw our own conclusions about what the actual truth is? And that's so dangerous, right? If you take, you know, the QAnon and all these wackadoos, and they're also using the same sort of strategy that we're using to discern the truth. They've just come up with a crazy fucking truth. And I don't even know what to do to disabuse them of that truth, because they have the same kind of evidence that I would use to debunk them. Yeah. It's the same information. But their conclusions are different. And so, you know, I feel like we as film critics have been kind of sounding this alarm for a long time. The death of critical thinking, and not just the death of critical thinking, but the death of tolerance of critical thinkers, has led us to this place where, you know, man, I would get like these like death threats for being a guy who's always bringing up racism. And so I was curious once, you know, 10 years ago, and I went back through all the stuff that I'd written, all these hundreds and hundreds of reviews. And I think out of all of them, I came up with like a percentage of like 2% of them ever talk about race of my whole output. And so my question back to the universe then at that point was like, do you believe that about 2% of everything that you see is racist, or do you think the number is actually greater than that? You know, but that any kind of discussion of race, any kind of discussion of these social issues has to be shattered down and beaten down into, you know, silence for some reason, you know, that, you know, even recently with licorice pizza. Literally with beating, especially when you get into fascist states. It's the intellectuals and the critics who are dragged out of the street and burned in the roadway first, because they're the ones that are raising an alarm, you know, early. You know, I think we do that when we analyze our art and we say, look, it's just like when they're the only way that we can tell if there's any Omicron at all in Florida is we analyze the wastewater. That's what we do as critics. You know, we're analyzing the output of humans, and we're finding stuff sometimes. And we're saying, look, there's 20 movies this year about vengeance. What do you think is happening? You know, there's like 30 movies about home invasion this year. What do you think is going on right now in the United States? What's happening right now?
And, you know, one of my favorite movies of the year, Riders of Justice. I'm like, isn't it funny that, you know, people, a whole bunch of misfits who've been downtrodden by the systems that they live in, you know, discover a wackadoo, you know, scientific scheme to hunt down and to enact justice, and then realize just how truly empty it all is in the end, and just by happenstance they get out of it. And I'm just like, that movie is so deeply flawed and ironic to the whole human condition that I'm like, this movie means so damn much to me for that exact reason. It's the beautiful farce of our existence.
Yeah, and that movie, like so many movies of this year too, is about finding a family. Is about creating family, creating a band of brothers, if you will. And, you know, again, that's really great on the one hand, and it's also really dangerous on the other, because there was a time in our history, in our human history, where these crazy ideas that are very popular right now would have been shunned as the sole idea of the village lunatic. You know, but now they go on the internet and they find like 10,000 other village lunatics from 10,000 other villages, and all of a sudden they have become a tribe. They become a group. And so Riders of Justice sort of kind of pings off of that idea as well. It's like, you know, what would happen if all the lunatics suddenly felt like they were right because they were being supported in their ideas instead of being sort of outcast and beaten from, you know, those ideas sort of beaten out of them a little bit by the louder voice of reason. You know, it's like, what would happen? Well, that the internet is what happened. Is that all of a sudden there's no idea too fringe for you not to be able to find a community that shares it. And, you know, again, that's a warning that the Parallax View offers too, is like when we corporatize atrocity, when we normalize it and we make it a button down 9-to-5 job to assassinate Medgar Evers and Malcolm X and Bobby Kennedy, when we can just sort of like hire somebody to do that from from Amazon or something, call up a political assassination, you'll have it by the next business day. And so there's, you know, that's coming. And so there's
one click, like, buy with one click, Walter, one click, political assassination.
And I think that's actually already a thing. And so, you know, not to get too tinfoil hat too late, I guess, but there's a sense of Parallax View here where I feel like it's right on the edge of all of the stuff that's happened. It's right on the edge of the Reagan administration. It's right on the edge of all these things. It's, you know, 6 years removed, but it's predicting these things. It's predicting this sort of cult of self-esteem, this cult of like feelings over knowledge, the cult of fringe over mainstream. And so, you know, we've upended our reality to, gosh, you know, coddle the fringe. And now the fringe is, you know, and we see it in film, like with Marvel stands and stuff, you know, like we've coddled the fringe and we've sort of gotten to this point now, I think collectively, where we're like, maybe it was a good idea that those guys were on the fringe. maybe it was a bad idea to stop stuffing these guys in the lockers. And it's like, there's a horrible knowledge about that, that, you know, those guys aren't better because they were traumatized in the past. Because now that, you know, they're Israel, they have the means, and now they're traumatizing another group. And so it's like,
it's messed up. But that's also, just to wrap up, that's also one of my favorite moments in this text is George Hammond's Jim Davis, that entire scene that happens in the cavernous, you know, hall that, you know, Pakula made the incredible choice to basically shoot the rehearsal rather than the actual thing, because the rehearsal is more revealing to the state of mind that you are to have the hubris to create those sort of forums in any event. But I just love those sweet kids turning those images and the free association that Jim Davis's George Hammond is doing by having his face as the punctuation on all of these incredibly progressive thinkers and these forward thinkers and these inclusive thinkers. And it's also hilarious because this is just another technique that unironically is used all the way to the Obama administration of, like, you know, like if you've ever seen a Barack Obama hope, two-tone picture that comes up and you've never seen the Parallax View, and then you watch the Parallax View, you're like, I think someone unironically used that same technique from Parallax, and Parallax is skewering it. It's going, this is not the way to do it. It's not the thing. And it's even the damn poster of like someone being shot and like splayed out Willem Dafoe in platoon style on the front of this thing. And I just, that's another moment that just strikes me as like, that talks about everything that we're talking about, which is like, here, this figure who, he's not progressive. He feels like this dominant Republican figure. He's there like practicing his golf swing. I mean, very pertinent to the last president of the United States, practicing his golf swing rather than rehearsing. And he is the punctuation mark after all those great and powerful figures that are displayed on those cards. And I just go, oh man, this is a bad joke. It's a bad joke, but it's so perfectly deployed in this movie.
Yeah. Well, the tagline on the poster, I'm sure you know, is as American as apple pie.
Yes.
It's the tagline of it. And there's like, you know, there's a, I think, you know, as I was growing up, you know, and you know, a really conservative family, you know, conservative area of Colorado and everything, it's like, you know, these people making these movies would have been derided as hippies and, you know, exaggerating the state of things and all of these things, and you know, sort of ridden hard for that sort of doomsaying. But I think time has shown that the only thing that's misplaced about them is not their nihilism and their fear, but their optimism.
Yes.
And that's the endearing, I think, lingering feeling that I have about the Parallax View, is that it's so sad because no one listened to Joe. And I'm not talking about anybody in the film, I'm talking about us. And that's where we're at now.
Well, look, thank you for making this possible. Thank you for being such a voracious fan. Thank you for your obsessions. And one thing that some people watch a Marvel movie and get nostalgia. I deeply get nostalgia from thinking about the countless hours I put in at the University of Newcastle Library watching 1970s movies on tiny screens on VHS. And so you talking about poring over those pictures for your thesis just brings back such fond memories of my own, you know, Parallax style re-education in the ways of the world and these 70s filmmakers who spoke to me. So truly, my friend, I love talking to you anytime. I love talking to you, especially about these movies that we find ourselves conversing over. And look, thank you for that beautiful piece with Karen and Phil that you put out into the world, because it's truly wonderful. I'm going to link it. I have already linked it in the Karen and Phil podcast episode, a post that's on our website. So it's already there for folks to see. They'll see it on yours as well. But, you know, me getting to not only have this commentary track, which is the coolest thing ever for a movie geek from Sydney ever, let me just say, as a person who watched Parallax for the first time on that VHS tape in that University of Newcastle library, but to talk about it with you and shoot the shit with you and realize that film criticism is merely examining the output and the waste of our society, it's just truly beautiful, and you're the best, and I can't thank you enough.
Well, hey, anytime. Blake, I can't wait to talk to you.
That was the incredible Walter Chaw. You can find him at Mangiotto, which is M-A-N-G-I-O-T-T-O. You can look for him at filmfreakcentral.net. That's where his heart is. That's where he is. Or if you have Netflix, jump on and watch Profane and Profound, his incredible contribution to David Fincher's Voir series. Thank you so much, Walter, for pointing out Karen and Phil to me and making them essential partners in this. Thank you for doing this. And guys, thank you for listening. If you haven't already, pre-order and get your hands on The Parallax View from Imprint Films, featuring a commentary by me. And we'll catch you on another episode from One Heat Man Productions soon. Hi, this is Blake Howard, host and producer of One Heat Minute Productions podcast. We dive into the great and underappreciated cinematic works, often 1 minute or one scene at a time. Our crew of guests are some of the most wonderful filmmakers, writers, authors, and critics ever assembled. Our shows include One Heat Minute, Josie and the Podcats, All the President's Minutes, Increment Vice, and right now, Zodiac Chronicle. Check out oneheatminute.com or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.